Adam 6.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Choreographer Matthew Bourne has a way with the classics. Actually, he has his way with the classics, and his latest effort, Sleeping Beauty, is a new take on an old chestnut that we'll talk about later in the program. First, a recap of what you did yesterday. It was election day, and Charlotteans voted on a new mayor and in races for city council, school board, and on a couple of bond issues. Join us to talk about what happened and what it might mean for the future is WFAE's Julie Rose, who joins us in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And Dr. Michael Bitzer, Associate Professor of Political Science and History at Catawba College and our political blogger for WFAE's The Party Line, joins us in our University City studio. First time ever we've split the focus here. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning. 22,000 people took advantage of early voting in Mecklenburg County. What did the final vote total look like? Does anybody know?
Yeah, we do. 115,000 ballots cast in Mecklenburg County.
Because there are a lot of races, and we'll talk about them later in the program, where they're still counting the votes, and the voter turnout was extremely low. I mean, the vote total in the race is low, and the gap between the candidates now is at 12 votes or something like that.
Right. We're talking about Pineville?
Yeah.
So long time mayor in Pineville there, George... I've got to get his name right here. George Fowler, longtime mayor. I mean, more than a decade he's served there and typically hasn't seen a challenger. But, the reports I've seen were that this challenger named John Jack Edwards was in bed when he found out someone called and said, hey, you're ahead. Did you realize this? you don't expect to beat an incumbent. But, yeah, I mean, a couple hundred votes cast for each of them, 12 votes now. Of course, these are unofficial. There are still other ballots to be tallied, provisional ballots and so forth. So,
is this typical for an off-year election, Michael?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we've got a voter turnout in Mecklenburg of about 17%. So less than 2 out of every 10 voters showed up yesterday. And this is kind of the norm. I mean, 4 years ago when Anthony Fox ran a very heated campaign against John Lasseter, that voter turnout was only 21%. 2 years ago, it was down to 16% when Fox ran for re-election. So this is kind of in the middle of what we would have expected.
The Charlotte mayor's race, of course, was at the top of the ballot, right below the soon-to-disappear option to pull the straight party lever. Any surprise on the outcome of the Charlotte mayor's race?
I don't think so. Was it a surprise to you, Michael?
Well, I think it was a surprise in that basically Cannon kind of mirrored what Fox did in his first run. I think a lot of us were expecting, okay, how Democratic of a dominance is Charlotte going to be? And this race kind of showed that indeed a kind of right kind of GOP candidate with a lot of things going his way can make it a competitive election. I mean, we're talking about a 53-47 split, and that's still a pretty competitive election. Mm-hmm. But even 4 years after Anthony Fox captured it, it's still a kind of when there are open seat elections, this could be potentially the sign that the right kind of Republican with the right circumstances could make it competitive, but still they lost. I mean, Republicans are third in terms of registration within the city. That's a huge hill to overcome.
And I know that Peacock and his group last night were encouraged at least by the spread that, you know, it was 5 percentage points as opposed to 35 when Stone ran against Fox. The open seat obviously makes a difference. But, you know, so they feel like there's a sign here that despite we knew we had an uphill battle is what they say. And look, you know, at least we didn't get totally run over.
Completely blown
Cannon
out.
Cannon took the west, the north, the east, and Peacock took the south, took southeast, Charlotte. Is that anything that's surprising at all?
No. I mean, that's the traditional geographic breakdown. If you layer a kind of letter, a capital letter A, on starting kind of in the central and running south in the city, that's the kind of traditional Republican area, South Park, Myers Park, that area, mm-hmm. but the rest of the city just fills in with complete blue.
Peacock served at large for several terms on the city council and lost a bid for re-election. He lost a bid for Congress, and now he's lost the Charlotte mayor's race. Mm-hmm. What does he have further political ambitions, and does this put a stop to it, or does the near win maybe encourage him to go forward with his political
ambitions? You know, I asked him about that when, because he's been a serial campaigner, basically, for many years. And I asked him, look, what are you going to run for next if this doesn't work out? And he said, you know, my wife is saying we got to do this, and I don't know that there will be another campaign. But, you know, he's young, and he grew up in a political household. I mean, he's been running campaigns and knocking on doors since his dad was running for mayor and city council and commission when he was just a little kid. So, I mean, you have to believe. He says it's in his DNA. We'll see. Citywide, winning citywide is really difficult for a Republican right now. He was the last one to do it when he was at large on the city council. So,
Democrats swept the city council in Charlotte, and, of course, Patrick Cannon won the mayor's race. So does that mean Patrick Cannon has a mandate?
As much as Anthony Fox had a mandate, yeah. And you saw how that worked out when, you know, when he had ideas regarding the streetcar or something that he, you know, this will be an interesting Democratic majority. Yes, it's still 9-2, but there was the people who you now see Patrick Cannon as the mayor, who he's basically just a tiebreaker, and Michael Barnes, who was the top vote getter among the at large, he switched to an at large seat from the 4th district up in the university area. Now he's the top vote getter, which means he'll probably be chosen by his colleagues to be mayor pro tem. Both of them were key in breaking from the Democratic majority over that whole streetcar situation. Yeah. So, I mean, we could see more divided votes, not 9-2, 9-2, 9-2, 9-2, as we've seen on a lot of things, and start seeing more 5-6s, which could make for an interesting path to chart in
Observers. The Observer is reporting this morning that there was some momentum for Peacock in the last days of the campaign because of some questions about Patrick Cannon and his truth-telling abilities on certain issues. What kind of a mayor, Michael, do you think Cannon will be, given the kind of campaign that he ran and what he said during the campaign?
Well, we have to remember that Charlotte's mayor is basically a very weak mayor form. Yes, he has the power of the veto, but really the power resides in an unelected city manager and in the legislative branch, which is basically the city council. I think what Charlotte mayors tend to do is to use their position as setting an agenda, putting forth the public's attention on the workings of government. And, you know, effective mayors tend to be those that can lead by persuasion, lead by building coalitions, lead by, you know, a sense of real leadership rather than trying to just say, this is the way it's going to happen. This is the way we're going to do it. So I think Cannon, if he's smart, is going to have to play that kind of role in terms of trying to be the leader and rather than, you know, be the absolute, you know, I am the mayor, do what I say.
And we haven't seen Cannon really be a major coalition builder. He wasn't the one that sort of led out on the streetcar or the budget. He has tended to kind of be non-controversial. He definitely connects with people. He has a kind of a populist voice. I'm one of you. I'm a common man. I came from where you came from. I think we need to go back to having the kind of mix in our economic situation where we have blue-collar jobs like what my mom did. I mean, that really connects with voters. But when it comes to, as Dr. Bitzer is saying, being able to forge majorities on the council to actually get things done, that'll be something that will be interesting for us to see because we haven't seen him really be a star in that way on the council.
And he will have to transition. He will have to go from being a city council member to being the mayor. And that's going to be an interesting transition oftentimes for folks who make that leap one way or the other.
Well, Pat McCrory, for about 14 years, was a full-time mayor, even though it's not a full-time position. He really ran it that way. Fox chose not to do it that way. How will Cannon approach this, given the fact that he is a businessman and he has a business to run?
Yeah, well, I mean, the job, he and Peacock both say, I mean, it's a full-time job, but he intends to continue running his business, which is this parking business, although, you know, even as a city councilman, that was not a full-time job, and we sure saw him a lot of places. So, you know, I mean, it's full-time, but not really, whatever you want to call it.
So Democrats swept city council last night. That gives them a super majority. I heard someone say the other day about that. If they win,
sure,
they get a super majority. How does that differ from what they already have?
No, it's the same. It's the same supermajority, except for, as I was explaining, the fact that you've got a couple of people now in top leadership roles, if you can call the mayor and the pro tem that, who are kind of known for breaking from the Democratic bloc occasionally. So we could see, Michael Barnes told me last night that he thinks this is a more moderate Democratic majority, which means that maybe the Republicans will actually get some votes on their side every once in a while.
We talked about this a little bit on Monday when we did a pre-election program, and that is the fact that for years the school board races were really contentious because school board was contentious. I mean, there were fights breaking out at school board meetings, and that's all kind of, you know, gone down to become very calm in recent years. What about the school board races? Only one incumbent lost. It was Richard McElrath, and interestingly, he had been a teacher in the system. I think he served, what, two terms?
Maybe one term, I think,
and
actually. Four years.
And one of his supporters, previous supporters, Thelma Byers Bailey, took 70% of the vote. What happened? She beat him.
You know, she says, she told our colleague Lisa Miller that she thinks this was a clear sign of people still frustrated and hurt over the school closures. I mean, she really ran on that, the closures down in the southern area there where she comes from, and that she, you know, feels like people are still sort of dissatisfied with the kind of recognition of what the parents need and what the teachers need, at least in that district, and that swept her in.
The bonds. I mean, there were two bond issues on the ballot, and the Observer reported or described support for school bonds as being fierce. They won
74%.
74% to 25%, and the CPCC bonds 71% to 28%. How do you explain that? The bonds always pass in Charlotte, even though most people say, "Don't raise our taxes. Money's not the problem. Don't throw money at things."
Yeah.
Well, we still vote for the bonds. Why is that?
I think I'll jump in here for a second. I was going to give you a second, Dr. Bitzer. First of all, this did not include an actual property tax increase this round, right? So people understood that these bonds were part of our existing debt capacity, right, that the county already has. So at least on that front, they didn't feel like they were necessarily voting for a tax increase. And I think that this was also something of a reaction. I mean, the legislature did a little bit of a favor to this bond effort, you know, by restricting funding, and very publicly, teachers have been very frustrated about, you know, pay and so forth. And so I think it's quite possible that voters thought, well, you know, we gotta do something for the school district because the legislature certainly didn't help us out.
I was just going to say,
I think the topic of education is front in a lot of people's minds, and this really sent a very clear signal that Charlotte and Mecklenburg want to make that investment. I mean, when you have bonds passing at 70%, that's a pretty big total.
As you look at the races throughout this part of North Carolina and throughout the state of North Carolina, and then you extrapolate out to the rest of the country, can you determine whether there has been any reaction to the shutdown of the government and the intransigence in Washington, mostly on the part of the Tea Party? Is there some sign that approach has fallen out of favor?
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the Virginia governor's race, I think we're still seeing, you know, they're going to come out of this and say, if only we had been better on the Republican side. I think this conflict.
Virginia, to be clear, in Virginia, McAuliffe, the Democrat won.
The Democrat won. There was great resistance, particularly in Northern Virginia, against the government shutdown. I think that helped push him into office. He needed all the help that he could get. But I think, you know, with Chris Christie winning a convincing number in New Jersey, this war within the Republican Party is going to continue.
Okay. Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of history and political science at Catawba College and the author of WFAE's political blog, The Party Line, and Julie Rose from WFAE News. Thanks very much for the time. Appreciate
Welcome,
it.
Mike. Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
When we come back, stay awake because we're going to visit Sleeping Beauty. All right? Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg County Recycling. Let's talk trash. The county is considering a proposed ban on certain recyclable and hazardous items from residential and commercial containers. Citizen feedback is requested. Details at wipeoutwaste.com. And Hendrick Honda Hickory offering new and certified pre-owned Hondas to the Charlotte Metro and Western North Carolina area on Highway 70 in Hickory and at HendrickHondaHickory.com. Tonight, Charlotte Talk celebrates its 15th anniversary with a conversation with Charlotte author, best-selling author Kasti Reichs in the McLuhan Theater here at Spirit Square. That starts at 7. If for some reason you have something better to do, like going to see Sleeping Beauty, well, we'll air that conversation tomorrow morning at 9. And speaking of Sleeping Beauty, the creator of this reimagining of this classic, Matthew Bourne, joins us in just a moment. Stay with us.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, post-election analysis of key state races and ballot initiatives across the country, including Virginia, New Jersey, and Alabama, how outside money and national trends are shaping state and local politics.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Choreographer Matthew Bourne is a man who has his way with the classics. He bends and shapes them in a manner that infuses them with new life, making them relevant to new audiences. In his production of Swan Lake, he used male swans. He transported Bizet's Carmen to a 1950s New Mexico truck stop and renamed it The Car Man. And in a production which came to Charlotte a few years ago, he reimagined Edward Scissorhands as a story told in dance. Well, now he's back with another Tchaikovsky classic, Sleeping Beauty, reawakened as a gothic romance complete with, should I tell them?
Why not?
Okay, vampires. It may be gothic, but it is also, oh, so 21st century. Sleeping Beauty opened last night at the Belk less than a year after its London debut, and that is largely thanks to the efforts of Blumenthal Performing Arts. The Charlotte organization has worked closely with Mr. Bourne on several of his projects, and Charlotte is the beneficiary because we get to see these newly conceived works while much of the rest of the country does not. We're joined by the rest of the hour by the creative mind behind this Sleeping Beauty, a man considered by many to be the most important choreographer in the world, Matthew Bourne. Welcome back to Charlotte and welcome back to the program.
Great to be back. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Tom Gabbard. He's the president and CEO of Blumenthal Performing Arts, which, as this collaboration illustrates, is more than just a roadhouse bringing in shows. They are involved in producing and incubating major projects, this one being just one of them. Welcome back to you.
Good morning.
Good to see you. You kind of rolled your eyes when I said that you had been called considered to be the most important choreographer in the world.
Mm.
Let me continue. I love eye rolls. The New Yorker calls you probably the world's most successful choreographer. The Village Voice says you're a virtuoso storyteller. You've been referred to as the undisputed king of dance theater, the ultimate showman. I said last night at a little get-together that we had before the show with some invited guests that you are the Cirque du Soleil of dance because you have productions running at the same time all over the world. How did this begin?
Oh, my goodness. It began with a young boy who really wanted to put on a show, I think. You know, it was always in me.
Where did that come from?
I don't know where it came from. I started doing it when I was about 4, in terms of just something that I got the local kids down the street to in my shows.
Had you seen shows, live shows?
Well, I lived in London. I'm a Londoner. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents were fans, basically, of movies and theater,
right,
and they took me to see things, and they made me watch things on TV.
So at 4, what kinds of shows were you producing?
Well, I would be taken to see a movie like Lady and the Tramp or Mary Poppins or something, and then I would try and remember it from one viewing and recreate it. That's what I used to do.
Yeah.
Maybe I had the LP or something as well to help me. I just tried to recreate what I'd seen. I fell in love with movies at a very young age.
And how long did that go on, these producing, you know, in the backyard or in the garage or in the living room? You put a blanket up across the sofa and that was your stage. How long did that go on?
Well, crazily, actually, far too long. You know, I was kind of doing this into my teens, and I don't know. It's interesting. I think that's quite naive back then. You know, even my parents as well. We should have recognized that I should have maybe gone to a performing arts school or college or something.
Yes,
but
because,
I didn't.
Because you didn't. What did you do? What was your educational path?
I went to ordinary school. You know, high school, ordinary school, mm-hmm. An all boys school. Not much arts provision there. didn't enjoy it at all, absolutely hated it, in fact. But all my part-time amateur stuff was going on. I had my own company when I was 14. I had another one when I was 18. But it was all in on an amateur level.
And was that a theater company?
A sort of dance theater company, songs and sketches and dances.
Now,
and
this is where it gets interesting, at least to me, because you have had this long history of creating these dance theater companies, and yet you didn't have any training in dance until you were 22 years old. That is when most dancers are thinking about retirement.
Yes.
How do you explain that? Why didn't you beg your parents to take dancing lessons? Why didn't they see this in you and send you to dancing school? Why did you wait so long?
Yeah, they saw it in me and they encouraged it and they helped me. My mum used to make costumes. My dad used to do stage management and things. I don't know why we didn't do it. There was something to do with being the peer pressure of not doing dance classes as a young man in East London.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I didn't want to do a ballet class. I used to belong to a local dance group, and I used to turn up after they did the class.
This is the Billy Elliot story.
Yeah, sort of. It is sort of. You know, I didn't think that was for me. So there's all those sort of pressures at that time. And all my love of dance came sort of, or dance specifically came later.
Because you've had a company, you've had this company, I believe, the one that you're working with on all these different projects for 25 years.
Yes.
You started training at 22. So how old were you when you started that company?
I was 27.
So 3 years into being trained, most people can't do a shuffle ball change by that time. And here you are starting a dance company, a legitimately professional dance company. How do you explain the ability that you had to do that and the confidence that people must have had in you to join your company after only 3 years of training?
Well, put it this way. I don't think I was the greatest dancer in the world, you know? Although I did perform for a while, I thought I was an okay performer. But maybe my talent was more to do with working with other people and bringing out their talents, you know? And so I think, but starting that late, I was not a great dancer. All the dancers I work with now are better than I ever was. So I think there was something in me that wanted to put on a show, like this showman thing that you talked about.
I knew that a little bit about you, because that you probably had more of a bent toward directing and choreography than performing yourself. But as I watched Sleeping Beauty last night, I just and obviously these dancers are all wonderfully trained and highly skilled, but I watched some of the things that you've asked them to do, and I thought, where did that come from? How do you demonstrate that? I mean, how do you tell a dancer, that's what I want you to do? How does that happen?
Well, I do have a good knowledge of what's possible, you know, and I know how to get it out of them. I just say, do that a bit more, or do that, extend that a little bit more. I don't have to actually demonstrate it to show it to them. They know what I'm talking about. Or style, you know, you've got references always to style. So, I work with them very collaboratively, and they'll give me a lot as well. Yeah.
Why dance to tell a story? Why does that turn you on?
Well, it started off with me thinking I wanted to be an actor, I guess, or a performer of some kind. I just assumed actor. So I tried a few classes when I was 15 or so and went to a local theatre club, theatre school, and I was so self-conscious about my voice, using my voice.
A great voice.
Well, as I said, I've learned how to do that now. And the irony is all I do is talk now. it's really all I do. But at that point, I steered towards movement because I found I could express myself better through movement. Mm. It's interesting. I've had a dancer a few years ago who stutters, and he found the same thing. You know, that it was the way he could express himself was through movement. Oh. I wasn't quite that bad. I didn't have a stutter. I just didn't like using my voice. Huh. So I started to be more about dance and movement and storytelling in that way than it was in any other form. And I wasn't really a good singer or anything like that. So dance became the thing.
You have been referred to as the outsider who makes other outsiders comfortable in the theater. Why are you an outsider if you agree with that statement?
Well, I think I don't fit into any easy slot. You know, I feel I'm... my work's referred to as dance theatre, and I do fall somewhere between the two. So in the dance world, I'm a little oddity. I'm probably seen as a bit commercial in some ways. In the theatre world, I'm like, oh, he's from the ballet world. You know, people are a bit scared of me in that sense. Yeah. So I sort of have my own form of theatre, really.
That really is interesting, because you have your foot in both worlds, but because of that... You're kind of a suspicious character. Mm. Is he a ballet artist or is he a theater guy? How do you see him, Tom?
Well, it's that melding that to me is part of why I find him fascinating. I see him as a great storyteller. Matthew did a piece a few years ago called Play Without Words. And ultimately, I think that describes all of what he does, that these are plays without words. He uses movement to tell the story in really compelling ways. He also has an incredibly cinematic way of composing scenes, and you can tell that this is a man who has watched a lot of film and has a strong cinematic sense. And so, you know, there are elements of this that I think just uniquely connect him with popular audiences that go to a more mainstream audience. And so clearly as a producer and as a promoter, I love the idea of work that connects with a larger popular audience.
And what is interesting about, well, I saw Edward Scissorhands when it was here, and the Sleeping Beauty I saw last night, is that this is attracting an audience that is part of the subscription series for the Broadway series. And what they're expecting is 9 to 5. Or Les Mis, or some splashy big singing, dancing spectacle. And you get that without the words here. And you're also, I would think, attracting an audience that may not necessarily just come to the Broadway series. They may be ticket holders with the ballet theater, the dance theater here. Is that what you're trying to achieve here? And the fact that he's an outsider making outsiders to theater feel comfortable in a theater, that seems to be important.
Yeah, that ability to cross these defined boundaries, as you say, it doesn't fit those descriptions. And I'm sure that there are some people, Matthew, you can correct me if this is wrong, but I'm sure that there are people that come regularly to see your work that love it, that don't go to a lot of other dance. They don't view themselves as dance people.
That's per
se.
Almost 85% of our audience are non-dance, you know, fans, really.
Now, because this is not, I suppose you could call it a ballet, but you call it dance performance or dance theater.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
It's a definition thing for a lot of people. Ballet, I don't like the word ballet much, because I think for a lot of people it conjures up tutus and pointe shoes and the past, in a way. Mm-hmm. But for some people, ballet is a story told without, you know, words, through movement. So, and I get that. And some people, I can't deny that that's a ballet. So I don't mind really what the definitions are, because I think they mean different things to different people. But I think what I do is I'm not working classical ballet technique. We use that, but we're using contemporary ideas. Sometimes you're watching something that's more like a scene. It's like a scene from a silent movie,
right,
where they're just acting.
Right. Garden scene is a good example of that, I think.
Yeah, it's a naturalistic sort of setting with costumes that look like they could be in a movie or a play rather than a dance piece. So they're not overly adapted. They wear normal shoes in that scene. For an audience that are used to watching theatre, it looks like it should look. It doesn't look like, oh, it's a dance, it's a ballet.
So when you first started producing things like this, when you first took those ideas and put them on a stage, what kind of reactions did you get from people?
Well, if you do anything that touches anything to do with tradition of any kind or things that are much loved by people, you're always going to be up against a little bit of resistance here and there until they get to know you a bit and know that you do it out of love. And for the pieces, I mean, for me, Tchaikovsky is—it's the best music ever written. So if you love musicals, you know, this is the best. Cameron McIntosh said it's, you know, it's the best music ever written. You don't have to worry if the lyrics are any good. but of course, it's bringing that music to a new audience as well, which is wonderful, I think.
And that's another thing. As I listened last night, I thought, if you had gone to see a traditional production of Sleeping Beauty last night with a full orchestra in the pit, you would have not been surrounded by the kind of sound that you are surrounded in with this, because this is a recorded track, playback magnificently on this. I couldn't find the speakers last night. Mm. Perhaps they're backstage or on the stage. I don't know where
they're around. They're hidden.
Yeah, they're hidden. Mm. And you are just enveloped in this glorious music. And then you're seeing these sights on the stage. The lighting is spectacular. The dancing is wonderful. And the set is so simple, but so intricate,
yeah,
all at the same time. How does that happen?
Well, it's many things. There's a lot of things you said there. But musically, I think people like to be surrounded now. They're used to it in cinema,
right, mm-hmm,
and in their home cinemas at home. You know, TV sound is so much better than it was. That acoustic sound that you get from a pit sometimes with Tchaikovsky, you need 80 musicians. We're never going to be able to tour with that. So I wanted I would like the audience to be overwhelmed by the music, and to feel it inside and to hear every little note of it. And that's really important to me, that they have that immersive sort of experience.
We have an email from a listener. He says, Mr. Bourne has an amazing intuitive sensibility to Tchaikovsky's score of Sleeping Beauty. It's as if his choreography and the dancer's execution of it breathes this wonderful music.
That's nice. Thank you.
That is very nice.
Yeah.
You've changed the story a little bit. Sleeping Beauty, and there are many stories to Sleeping Beauty.
Mm.
People think of the Disney story, I suppose, but that's not the real story. And then there's the story of the Russian ballet, which premiered in 1890.
90, yeah.
But you've switched it up a bit.
Yeah, like all versions, you know, some people do say, oh, well, this is very much Matthew Bourne's version of Sleeping Beauty. Well, so is Disney's, and so is every other version you see. There's the ballet, as you say. And Disney actually recognized something in it that I did as well. That there's not the basic story is not a good love story. And he gave the heroine, she falls in love with the prince ahead of time in the Disney movie, which people think is the classic story. But he invented that. And we've done a similar thing. We've beefed up that side of the story. So all versions are different. Ours is a little bit more different, maybe. As you mentioned earlier, there's a few surprises of a vampiric kind. But it's not what the piece is about, I would say. It's not about vampires.
No.
It's an important plot point.
It allows how you've decided to tell the story to be plausible.
Exactly. It's a sort of fairy tale logic that we, mm-hmm, found in it. Mm-hmm. I wanted very much to keep telling a fairy tale and have those rules, you know, and you invent them in a way. You create them.
There's something going on in our culture right now with Grimm on NBC, mm-hmm, and with Once Upon a Time on ABC, and now with you, where we're taking all these folk fairy tales and blending them into one. So all these different kinds of characters and all these different characters have an opportunity to meet in stories where they were always kept in silos before.
Yeah.
Why does that work?
I think what it is that everyone has a certain knowledge of these characters and these stories. So it's for writers or for choreographers or whoever you may be, a director, you can play with them because you play with the knowledge people already have. So when I look at Sleeping Beauty, I know that people have and it's an element of the story that everyone gets, and that is the girl that sleeps for 100 years and she gets woken by a kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to be true love's kiss that wakes her up. Now, I play with that in my story, that one guy, the guy who's the evil guy in my story, cannot wake her up with a kiss. It doesn't happen. He needs the guy who really is in love with her to wake her up, so he tricks him in a way.
Yeah.
So, but I couldn't do that if the audience didn't already know that element of the story, because otherwise it's just a guy kissing a girl who's asleep.
Mm-hmm.
They need to know that that's going to wake her up. So you can play with these ideas. And I think these series that you mentioned, they play with what we already know of Red Riding Hood, all these myths and stories that we already know.
We have to take a break. Matthew Bourne is our guest. He's the choreographer of Sleeping Beauty, which opened last night at the Belk and runs through November 10th. Also with us, Tom Gabbard, president and CEO of the Blumenthal. We're going to talk about this collaborative effort, transatlantic collaboration, in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Jerusalem, now showing in IMAX at Discovery Place. Journey to one of the world's oldest and most enigmatic cities, exploring history and discovering our common heritage. Ticket information at discoveryplace.org. And celebration of Seagrove Potter's Gala, including a preview pick of pottery, catered reception, live music, and collaborative auction Friday, November 22nd. Details at celebrationofseagrovepotters.com. Just as we had post-election analysis earlier on the program, Diane Rehm does too, with key state races and ballot initiatives across the country, including Virginia, New Jersey, and Alabama. Diane and her guests discuss state election results, the influence of outside money, and how national trends are shaping state and local politics. I want to remind folks that there are still tickets available for tonight's conversation with Kathy Reichs at the McGlowan Theater. Information at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Public Radio goes to the ends of the earth to bring you the heart of the story. We're on the ground and in the mix, even in harm's way. Through conflict and chaos, we investigate, examine, and explore. We don't rest until every side gets their say. The world is a complicated place. Public Radio delivers vital news from every corner of the globe.
Listen for in-depth news throughout the day here at 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Matthew Bourne is with us, who has, I'm told, the world's longest-running ballet production, Swan Lake.
That's right.
He's the choreographer of Sleeping Beauty, which is at the Belk through November the 10th. Tom Gabbard is the president and CEO and responsible for the fact that Matthew Bourne is sitting in this room right now and that his show is sitting a block away in the Belk Theater. When did this collaboration begin, and how did you become aware of Matthew?
I was first introduced to Matthew about almost 11 years ago. We met in London and began a conversation that involves a number of my colleagues across the country, a group that we help to manage called the Independent Presenters Network. So we began a conversation about trying to bring Matthew's company to the U.S. He has this incredible following in the U.K., and we wanted to see if we could nurture that over time here in the States. So I've organized this group to actually invest in four of his productions. This is the fourth. Two of them we've managed to get to the States, Edward Scissorhands and Sleeping Beauty, but two others, The Carman and Cinderella, we haven't yet. Hopefully we'll get
although
them here.
Although The Carman seems to be a perfect ballet or dance production to bring here because it's set in New Mexico.
All in good time. But even though we haven't got them over here, they've all been financially successful just from the London runs. Mm-hmm. I really believe in Matthew, and this has frankly been about investing our efforts behind a visionary that we think really is leading the art form and creating things. Hopefully for many years to come, that will be satisfying to audiences.
Of course, he has his own company and producing his own pieces of theater and dance, but you also have been associated with lots of musicals. Among them, we saw your – people saw your choreography and probably didn't realize it when they went to see Mary Poppins when it was at the Belk, because that is your choreography. That's your work. You also
That's
did
right.
Oliver. You also did My Fair Lady. What are some of the other musical theater pieces that you've worked
on?
Well,
I haven't done that many, actually. I sort of handpick them, and I have this relationship with Cameron McIntosh, the great musical producer, and I've tended to work with him, and Oliver was the first one I did, and I really wanted to do it. They're all pieces I grew up with loving. Didn't feel they had an identity, particularly choreographically.
Oliver is a flawed piece of theater.
Do you think? Why?
Because it's not satisfying. I mean, it's wonderful. The music is wonderful. The lyrics are wonderful. I like the story. They've brightened up the story from what the book is like. Mm. But, you know, everybody dies in the end.
Well, I think there's a lot of death in Les Mis, isn't there?
Except
That's
for
the
Oliver.
Most successful.
Oliver survives.
It's so beloved, that piece, in the UK.
Oh, I love it.
You can do it, you know, you can do it endlessly, and the people love it. It's sing-along time, you know.
Absolutely.
But Mary Poppins I really fought to do as well. I don't know whether I needed to fight to do it, but I made sure Cameron knew that if ever that happened, I wanted to do it, you know, and I'd be there. I'd do it for free.
That perked his ears up.
And Mike, Matthew, I think you actually have a co-director credit on that
yes.
as well.
Yeah.
So he really had, since he'd be too humble to say this, had a great influence in bringing that together. That was a project that that was years in gestation because Cameron had one view of what the show was to be and Disney had another view. And Matthew my understanding is Matthew really played a pivotal role in trying to bring those folks together. I mentioned to him years ago after that happened, I said, we need to send you to the Mideast now after your ability to bring different visions together.
We seem to have a lot of transatlantic British-American collaboration going on. There are a lot of lead characters on television right now in America that are actually British actors speaking with American accents, so a lot of people don't even know they're from Britain. On Downton Abbey, there are a couple of Americans on that incredibly popular show on both sides of the ocean, and now we have these collaborations that you've been doing, and I suppose others, and this is not the only British collaboration that you've had going in the past.
We actually, I think, are a national leader in that, and a lot of people, particularly here in the States, look to us as a resource to be a connector on these things. So things that people have seen here on our stages, for instance, Frost Nixon, that even though it was an American subject, that was actually originated in London at the Donmar, did play Broadway but was not going to tour, and so we went to the Donmar and were able to put together a U.S. national tour of that production. Going the other direction, the musical 9 to 5, which we were involved with on Broadway but then actually produced the national tour and substantially changed the show, that then was taken to the U.K., has toured very successfully in the U.K., and is now on track to open in London. So we've been involved with many, many productions going both directions because we think, frankly, anytime you can take a production and share costs among a lot of different venues, a lot of different ventures, that's good for everyone.
But aren't there costs in – we hear so much now about American manufacturing being brought back to the continent because it costs too much money to ship products from Korea. What about shipping costumes and sets and lights and creative people and dancers and singers and performers from Britain to America? Are there not costs and also logistical nightmares involved in all of that?
Well, that is a huge complication in all these things, and certainly necessitates having some time to move all these things. It's certainly a different cost to travel by air as compared to a container ship. But yeah, it's certainly a complicating factor in how this all comes together.
It's probably one of the reasons why it is so difficult to bring us here, and that's why I appreciate Tom's efforts on our behalf, because we do big productions with big sets, 160 costumes, the whole company comes over. It's not a cheap enterprise. It's a very expensive prospect to bring us.
How do you do that? How many people in the company?
There's 24 in the dancing company, right. and there's the crew as well. But we do have an American crew that we pick up along the way for this tour who learnt the show.
Because it really is. That's a lot of people and a lot of money behind the scenes. And I guess that tells you why ticket prices are what they are. Not that they're terribly expensive, but that's why things cost.
Well, and this tour is only stopping in 7 cities. So there are limited number of cities that are going to have the opportunity to see this. You go on, Matt, remind me.
Are we going to Washington,
to the Kennedy
D.C.
Center
next week, Kennedy Center, and then to 2 weeks at the Armisen in L.A.? Mm-hmm. And we've already played Des Moines and Cleveland and Schenectady and New York. So they're the cities.
They're just coming off of two weeks in New York City at City Center.
Ah. Talk to me about why the Blumenthal is involved in things like. It would be easy for you to just call producers in New York and say, okay, what are you sending out next year? And, okay, we'll take that one. We'll take one from column A, one from column B. But you have figured out that doesn't work.
Well, I think we would be falling short of our mission to serve this community and enrich the community. We two key things in our mission statement focus on best in the performing arts and the second, education and enrichment. And a production like this, I think, exemplifies both. We could just focus on one piece of it. We could just, bring well-known Broadway titles through and then fail on the mission piece of enriching the community. And that's where I just think it's such an honor for us to have a visionary like Matthew that's moving the art form forward, that our audiences are getting a sense of what the future holds.
Would it be easier for you to do what you've done if you were in Britain, because Britain supports the arts. The government of England supports the arts. We don't.
Yeah, there unfortunately is a difference. And right now, I have to say, I think what's going on culturally in the UK is more interesting right now. And the government piece does play a role in that. In this case, this production, I think the Arts Council has supported a third of the cost to mount it.
Their Arts Council.
And so raising the commercial side of it, raising that commercial investment, is certainly easier knowing that the Arts Council has provided this money to make it happen.
When there are so many other needs that every society has, why do people in the UK feel okay about funneling money into the arts? Because as I understand it, the Arts Council that you work with on your productions will give you money. Well, they'll put money toward projects that they think are worthwhile, but they don't necessarily recoup any of their costs. If there's a profit, they don't take the profits.
No, they don't take the profits, but they want to know where it goes. They want to know that it's going back into new work and going back into the company. So they keep an eye on it. There's certain things you have to guide, certain guidelines. Mm-hmm. But it's not an enormous amount of government spending. It's a fraction of any other.
But why? Why spend any of it?
Because
and how politically does that get past the voters?
I think they appreciate it ultimately. I mean, you'll always have the people who don't agree with it, of course. But I believe that if you get public money, you serve the public, you know. And as Tom said, you enrich the lives of the people who come and see the work. And I think we do appreciate that in the UK. I think we see that as an important part of life. You know, that's something that we all need in our lives. But I do believe, you know, there's a certain responsibility when you get public taxpayers' money.
Yeah.
And you have to deliver.
When you look at our system, and I suppose you've been here enough over the years in this country to have overheard discussions about medicine and how we fund medicine other, you know, social funding of things, what do you think? What goes through your mind? Do you think we're missing the boat?
Well, maybe I don't know enough about it to comment in properly, but I certainly, something like the National Health, which everyone people do complain back home a lot about the National Health. They complain about arts funding, that we don't get enough, all that kind of thing. It goes on because we're used to it, you know. But when I come here and see the difference in the arts and in healthcare and things like that, I think I realize how grateful I am for those things.
What is the difference in the arts?
The difference in the arts, just that it's supported in on government level, you know. That I think that's the difference, and we've got used to that. And here, I think you have to work harder with people who support the arts, individuals who support the arts. And I think it's getting a little bit more like that in the UK now.
So because we have to work harder, and because it has to be more commercial, because it's people's, individuals' money going into the productions that make it on Broadway and then they make their way out on the road, are we not throwing support to things that you get to see because you are throwing support to smaller things, to smaller efforts, to more fringe work that perhaps it's not going to be a commercial success, but that will be an artistic success?
Well, the Arts Council is there for that. That's one of the reasons it's there, to support work that wouldn't necessarily get funding in any other way. I'm lucky and I can attract people who would help me to put my shows on, donors or sponsors or whatever, because of the how popular it is. But of course, the other side of what an Arts Council does is support work which initially maybe is a little different and needs that encouragement, and that's so important.
Matthew Bourne is the choreographer of Sleeping Beauty, which is playing at the Belk through Sunday. And he has a specialty of reimagining older stories and breathing new life into them. We mentioned The Carman. It's Bizet's Carmen, set in New Mexico in 1950s in the truck stop, and it's kind of Hitchcockian in its field. Do you do it in black and white?
I've done that, but not in that one. Yeah.
you set Cinderella in Blitz-era London. You've got this goth twilight motif for Sleeping Beauty. You came to fame because of the fact that you put men as the swans in Swan Lake as opposed to women. You've done a production of Lord of the Flies, a picture of Dorian Gray. What attracts you to the classics, and where do the ideas come from to switch them up?
Well,
That's just my instinct. It has to. I can only put it down to that. I take a story, as I said, you know, something that people already feel they know, and then do something with it, using what they know of it. And it's not always a ballet, as you mentioned. You know, it's sometimes it's a novel, mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a movie. Mm-hmm. The piece that Tom mentioned, Play Without Words, was based on a fairly obscure British film called The Servant that not maybe a lot of people know. So sometimes I'm working with subject matter that people are not completely au fait with, you know, don't know that well. I think what I do with the Tchaikovsky pieces and the pieces with great scores, I just listen to that music and see if I can get the images that are already in my head out of my head and try and imagine other things in the music. Mm. So I sort of see it as a script in a way. And what's that script telling me? And dance is the hardest thing, you know, to get going with, because on day one of rehearsals in a play, you can sit around in a circle and read the play, and the actors can, and then everyone's happy, you know, you're halfway there.
you've read it.
Well, you know it's there. You know it's a good piece of work. Yes, you know you've got this play and you want to do it, and you're 50% of the way there, maybe more. With dance, there's a room of people all staring at you. You know, like, what do we do? What is it? I don't know anything about
it. Do you make it up on the spot? Have you thought it through? Do you know what you're going to do when you go into that rehearsal?
Not completely.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm ready to change, always.
That is brave.
Keep alive. Keep the ears and eyes alive, yeah.
Part of the mission of the Blumenthal is educational outreach, because that has to be a component of every arts project in Charlotte, it seems to me. And there's a part of this that's an educational outreach, and I have a minute left here. Matthew is taking part of his company to a school in Union County. What's going to be happening out there?
Matthew, why don't you explain this, because this is your program.
Is this the curtain raiser?
Right.
Yes, we're going to, this week, we'll be working with some young people in the area around ideas of Sleeping Beauty, and they will do their own creative work around that with some of my company members. And on Sunday, they will be presenting that work to the hopefully full house at the Belk Theatre before our show, so they get to perform their piece in front of a full house in this amazing theatre.
I take it you've done this before.
Yeah, we do it. We try to do it in as many venues as we can.
And what do these kids take away from that experience?
Life-changing experience sometimes. Sometimes it's just the thrill of it and being there on stage with the company and the audience reactions.
So if you want to see something special, the Sunday matinee,
Sunday matinee is
the time to go. Matthew Bourne, choreographer for Sleeping Beauty. Tom Gabbard, the president and CEO of Blumenthal Performing Arts. Sleeping Beauty is at the Belk Theatre through November the 10th. That's Sunday. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.